I'm Marty Moscow-Wayne. Welcome to Radio Times. Julie Lithcott-Hames was born in 1967, the same year as the famous U.S. Supreme Court Loving decision that put an end to state laws prohibiting interracial marriage. But that didn't mean her parents, her black father who was a physician, her white mother who was a teacher, didn't have to deal with hostile and judgmental stares and comments. She was raised in all-white neighborhoods and attended largely white schools and was told by her parents that they were a black family, even though clearly one of them wasn't black. This was confusing to a young girl. She says she felt like the other. A white friend once said to her, "I don't think of you as black. I think of you as normal." Julie Lithcott-Hames has written a memoir, Real American, about her struggles to accept and understand herself as a biracial black woman. Her previous book, How to Raise an Adult, was a bestseller, and she joins us on Radio Times to talk about race, identity, family. And Julie Lithcott-Hames, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Marty, thanks so much for having me.
You're welcome. Here's how your book begins. Where are you from? Here. No, I mean, where are you from? That's how your book begins. How did you interpret that question?
Throughout my childhood, I got that question. The corollary was, what are you? You know, the implication was, I can't figure you out. I don't know what you are. And until I can figure out and classify you, I'm not sure how to treat you.
If you had lived in, let's say, black neighborhoods, would you have gotten the same question, do you think?
Well, that's jumping right into it, Marty, because, of course, I don't know. And, of course, I was growing up in the 70s, and I think our consciousness today as black people includes an awareness of the great diversity in the black community. But I bet if I'd been in a black community in 1975 with my light skin and my biracial hair, I might have gotten some of those questions from black folks, too.
Your parents met in Ghana.
They did.
How did they meet?
Oh, my goodness. My dad was a U.S. diplomat. He was a physician helping eradicate measles and then smallpox in West Africa. My mother was 20 years younger, a school teacher from England who came on a fellowship to teach nursing students math and science. They met at a party of expats, of Americans and Brits. My dad was escorting James Baldwin's sister that night who was visiting Ghana.
Oh, wow.
And they got into a conversation and they were rapt. He noticed the time. Oh, my gosh, I have to get her to the airport. She's taking the midnight Pan Am flight back to the States. Will you wait for me? She said yes. She waited. He didn't come back. She finally went home feeling stupid for thinking this African-American doctor might be interested. But he did come back looking for her and ultimately tracked her down. And they were together from that night till he died in 1995.
A real love story?
Real love story. And a transgressive love story. It was literally breaking the law in America for them to be married. Now, they were in West Africa where it was legal. But there was no question that it was highly unusual and highly transgressive for my mother and father to dare to be in love and to have me.
In fact, you describe walking with your dad holding his hand as a little girl and seeing people look at him.
Yeah.
Same thing with your mother, who's white, and seeing how people looked at both of your parents. As a little girl, how did you interpret that?
So I was 3 or 4. This would have been in Rockland County, New York, where I lived as a little girl. Maybe it was Manhattan if I was in the city one day with either parent. And not all strangers, but a number of strangers, enough to catch the attention of a young child, seemed to look at my father with eyes, as I say in the book, that steamed like a cauldron, as if they could brand him with their searing look. My mother got looks that were more subtle and harder for me to discern or understand as a little kid, looks of confusion or pity or a little bit of disdain. She herself will tell that story of sitting with me maybe in a subway and a stranger looking at her with that look that says, "I know how you got that brown child," and the implication being that her having slept with a black man was inappropriate.
Was transgressive.
Mm-hmm.
Interestingly, though, and this is where your story and this book gets really complicated, is that your parents were determined to be a quote-unquote black family, and yet you lived in largely white neighborhoods. And as a little girl, I mean, much of your book is struggling to understand how you fit into these two worlds.
Yeah. So any sociologist in the 1970s, any psychologist, child psychologist, sorry, not sociologists, psychologists, was saying, if you have a mixed race child, which was a pretty unusual thing to have back then, you raise this child with a black identity because America will see them as black and they better be black and proud. So that was the almost the public service announcement that mixed race families received. And my parents believed that and they adopted it. Now, the trouble was the white communities they raised me in, right, and the fact that daddy was at the height of his career. He was traveling. He was one of the first to go into China when Nixon reopened China to Americans. My father went with a team of doctors for 6 weeks. I'm a little kid. My daddy's not there. My white mom is basically the main person in my life. So my white, the task of raising me to be a black person fell into the hands of my white British mother. She tried her darndest. She knew I needed black dolls. She knew I needed posters and imagery and books featuring black characters written by black people. But it was bewildering for me to try to figure out what does it mean, how to live and breathe the reality that we are a black family when, in effect, I didn't have black role models around me.
Why did your parents pick what were essentially white neighborhoods?
Well, my father's been gone 22 years, and I was 27 when he died, and I did not have the courage to ask him that while he was alive. I think, as many people choose to do, as their affluence rose, they chose to purchase homes in communities with better public schools. And better public schools are tied with affluence, and affluence reflects race and all of that. So I think they thought they were doing right by me, but in hindsight, what I would say, if I could turn it all back, I would plead, particularly in my adolescence, I would plead to attend a high school that was diverse. It was extremely hard. I was the one black kid out of 1,200 in my high school. Wow. And my dad saw this photo of me with this boy I had a crush on, this white boy. And it was this photo, we're laughing and giggling, and I had this crush. And my dad saw the picture, and he said, "Baby, white boys will be your friend, but they'll never date you." And Marty, I didn't know how to say to my daddy, "Why did you move me here? Don't I deserve love? I'm a teenager. Why did you make that choice?" Again, I didn't have the language. I wouldn't have known how to ask that respectfully. I didn't even know then how damaging it would turn out to be, I guess is part of the point. So these are deep regrets.
Let me ask you a couple of questions about your mom, who you describe as, and I'm looking here. Mom was the blackest white lady I knew, maybe even the blackest person I knew. Was she play acting, or did she identify? Did she identify with being black?
My mother left England in 1959 for West Africa and spent 7 years there. She left in 62 and spent 7 years there. Moved to the States in 69. And so her 20s were spent in West Africa, in Accra, Ghana, in Lagos, Nigeria. She very much found a sense of belonging in Ghana. She felt embraced by the Ghanaians and Nigerians as well. So she came to America in 1969 with the Dutch wax print cloth, which was, you know, the typical fabric that women in Nigeria would wear, that white Americans saw as transgressive, as Black Panther, as Black Power, as political, as violent. And here she was just thinking, hey, this is, I've never been to America before, but this is what I used to wear in West Africa. So in some ways, I mean, she became an African, not by birth, not by genetics, but certainly immersed herself in culture and cared to know her community. So I think she did have an authenticity. She was not play acting.
Right.
You know, I say in the book, I love the fact that my mother could pronounce the name Entesaki Shange accurately, whereas many white folks look at the name Entesaki Shange and don't have the first clue how to pronounce the first two letters. And she enjoyed being culturally literate, being au courant about black intellectuals, black artists, issues in the world that affected black people. So she was pretty woke, to use the language we use today, and not play acting.
You're right, though. I would physically bristle when my mother referred to us as a black family. She seemed to be trying to join a club that seemed rational to want to leave.
Well, because at the same time, she was not treated as a black person when she walked down the street. And she and I have these conversations to this day.
Yeah.
When Charlottesville happened, I was the one to let her know she's not up on social media, so she gets the news a little bit later than me. And I said, Mom, did you hear what happened in Charlottesville? And she said, no, what? And I told her about white supremacists and Nazis marching in the street. And she said, my God, that's awful. That's so awful. And then she started talking about North Korea and, you know, other issues. And I said, Mom, I just need a hug. And she's like, of course. No, this is so terrible. It's so hard for us all. And I said, you know what? It's actually, I think, a little bit harder for me because they have a target on my back, not yours. And even the most woke white liberal. And she said, I am more than a woke white liberal. And I said, Mom, I'm just saying, for me as a person of color, this is not an experience you can share. You can love me. You can bring all the compassion and all the wokeness you want. But at the end of the day, my experience walking down the streets of America is different than yours because of your white skin and the privilege that comes with it. So
did she understand that?
She did. I mean,
was that a revelation for her?
You know, this was a hard conversation. And it really allowed me to reflect on if Mom and I are having a tough time talking about Charlottesville, and not because she agreed, she didn't call the other side good people or anything, right? But simply the sort of whose feelings do we want to talk about first was kind of where we were. If Mom and I are having trouble with this conversation, what is this like for friends or coworkers across America?
Was she hurt by that?
I think she was initially, but as we talked it through, I think she was able to appreciate that. She had jumped in with her own sense of things rather than taking an interest in what it might be like for me. And I was really frightened. I was actually looking at 49 years of age for my mother to comfort me because, you know, I'd seen those imagery, the imagery of the KKK as a young child, and it terrified me. And I think many of us thought that they had really begun to go away. And what that was naive, of course. We realized they didn't go away. They were hiding. And they've been emboldened. And so, you know, I had a lot of childhood triggers pushed when Charlottesville happened.
Because you grew up in white neighborhoods, you think?
No, because, I mean, I didn't have the KKK evident in my neighborhood, but I remember watching the evening news. My parents watched the news every night. And to see the imagery of the burning crosses and the people with white hoods. And I saw an image of a child in a Klan robe that just broke my heart because it was a small child. And I was maybe 8 or 9 and this child was 3 or 4. And I just was both terrified by the hateful violence and to see the next generation already cloaked in the robe really broke my heart.
Let's take a very short break and then we'll get back to our conversation. That's Julie Lithcott-Hames, our guest in this hour of Radio Times. A couple of years ago, she wrote a bestseller called How to Raise an Adult. Her new book is a memoir. It's called Real American, and it's about being the daughter of a black father and a white mother. And you can join our conversation by calling us at 1-888-477-9499. You can also send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. We're going to talk more about her dad and have her do a reading after this very short break. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. And I'm Marty Moscowane talking with Julie Lithcott-Hames about being a biracial black woman, about what her life has taught her about identity and race and family. And speaking of family, I would love to have you read a chapter about your dad, who you called Daddy.
Yep, we all called him Daddy. He was beloved. And he died 22 years ago, October 7th. So I'm delighted to get a chance to just be with him on your show here right now. Yeah. This is from the part of the book called An American Childhood, Part 3. Sorry, American Childhood, Chapter 3. I adored Daddy. He was 50 when I was born, and my childhood coincided with the heyday of his career, which began against all odds amid the racial hatred of the segregated Jim Crow South. I was his last child of 5, the product of his second marriage to my mother, and I knew from the way his eyes twinkled whenever he looked at me that he loved me no matter what. He gave me a variety of nicknames, old sport, knucklehead, which sounds crude to my grown ears, but then, spoken in the butter of his baritone, it felt like melted love. He never had to call for me twice. I came running every single time. When I was little and skinned my knee, he'd pull me up onto his tall lap, kiss me, and ask with all seriousness how I was going to become Miss America with that scar. I didn't know then that no black woman had yet been crowned Miss America, and that no black woman would be crowned Miss America until 1983. Instead, I heard in Daddy's words that I was beautiful, perhaps the most beautiful girl he'd ever seen. We all called him Daddy, even my mother. He was formidable, commanding, gruff, loving, and funny. I hung on to his every word, whether it was, "Baby, bring me my cigarettes," or a well-placed retort to the news recited by the anchorman on TV. Daddy was the protagonist, the lead. Daddy was the son.
I love that section. It's great. Thank you. When you can love your daddy. And you called him Daddy to the bitter end, right?
I'm not kidding. We all did. My mother, too. It was who he was. Even his medical students, family friends, some people called him Dr. George. No one called him George. And he didn't like the formality of Dr. Lithcott.
So he wanted. His medical students didn't call him Daddy, though.
Probably not the medical students, but the friends of the medical students. I mean, this was a man who knew. You know, he was appointed by President Carter to be the Assistant Surgeon General, but he knew the name of the guy who ran the elevator,
right?
And so he was very accessible and very. He made you feel cherished, whether you were his daughter or a colleague or a student, a mentee or a stranger.
Did he talk to you about the Jim Crow South?
No.
Why not, do you think?
I think, like many people of his generation, he was born in 1918. He didn't want to talk about it. You know, you ask people who fled Vietnam, they don't want to talk about it.
Too painful.
Too painful. He would tell funny stories. He would tell jokes. One day they were watching. So my dad was on the faculty at Oklahoma, University of Oklahoma Medical School, the first black person to hold a professorship at a medical school in the South. And they hired him, obviously knowing he was black. Then a new dean comes in and they tell the dean candidate, "We have a black man on our faculty." And the guy's like, "It's no problem." And then he got hired, didn't talk to my dad for almost a year, and then finally called him into his office and said, "I can't have someone on my faculty that I won't have over to my house for dinner." So he was being told to leave. And then he would tell a story about watching the Oklahoma Sooners play football. You know, and he's in the stands as a faculty member sitting next to a white person who says, "Look at our colored boy get there, N-I-G-G-E-R. Okay, they're watching a football game. The Sooners are playing someone else. The Sooners got a colored boy, but the opposing team is full of the N-word players. So I would hear stories like that.
You even moved into a neighborhood, and one of the white girls that lived there said that that when your family moved in, he was mistaken for the gardener, I guess, because he was mowing the lawn or something like that. But the assumption was that no black family would move into this neighborhood, and if there was someone black in this neighborhood, they had to work for this family as opposed to be the family.
Absolutely. And we had just moved from Washington, D.C., where my dad had just stepped down from his post as Assistant Surgeon General under Jimmy Carter, which was pretty damn cool. Darn cool. Sorry, public
radio.
You
can say damn.
I can say damn. That's excellent. Good. I'll try out some more words on you in a second. he loved to mow his lawn. He had a big riding mower, one of these John Deeres. Here we are in Wisconsin. And, you know, he's proud of the home he's purchased and the lawns and the flowers. And the neighbor told me, my young neighbor friend, you know, "I'm not supposed to tell you this, but my big sister thought your dad was the gardener, and my parents told her not to say," you know, like the parents were mortified, but the little girl felt the need to tell me, as if that was the greater kindness to tell me it. To be frank, I wish I'd never known, because I couldn't look at them the same way, knowing that they'd not because of what the sister said, but because they'd had to have this big conversation, hush hush, about my family.
Did you have white friends? I mean, were there girls, maybe even boys, that you felt like, even in hindsight, that they were friends of yours?
Absolutely. I went to high school in Middleton, Wisconsin. I had some really great friends. And yet, when somebody wrote the N-word on my locker, I'm student body president. Right. I'm in my all-white high school. I'm college-bound, you know, when many people weren't. And on my birthday, somebody writes the N-word on my locker, and I didn't tell a soul, Marty. I didn't tell my best friend. I didn't tell the school. I didn't tell my parents, because I was ashamed that it had happened. I felt somehow it was my fault. I didn't want to draw further attention to my blackness. And so this is my way of saying great friends, and yet nobody who could reach a hand out when I had fallen, no one to reach their hand out and pull me up, no one to put an arm around my shoulder and say, you know, I've been there, you'll be all right. I needed somebody older, you know, or a peer who could just understand and be in, you know, have some solidarity with around what, you know, a quote from Michelle Obama at the top of the show, the small cuts, maybe that feels minor, but that does something to you. Michelle Obama said at the Pennsylvania Conference for Women yesterday, and I heard her say it. That's what I'm talking about. So the fact that I had great friends is irrefutable. Mm-hmm. And yet there wasn't a depth. There was not a depth of knowing that we could share with each other because our lives were so fundamentally different at the level of race.
And you couldn't tell your parents either.
I mean, by this point, I'm 17. My parents have told me we're a black family. They've left me to figure out what that means by plunking me down in white towns. I have only the Cosby Show and the Jeffersons and Good Times and, you know, other forms of media to tell me what blackness is. And of course, then the shows were just full of stereotype. And so I was frustrated with my parents at this point. I mean, they would say things like, we wish you had more black friends, and yet they raised me in white town. So I thought they were criticizing me, saying I didn't like black people. And I began to think, well, do I? I mean, what is happening? How did I get myself here? So my parents did not feel like allies in this cause at that point. And I knew that they would react. They would be frustrated. They would be angry. They would want to march on the school. And I just wanted to hide. And the trouble was, in not telling anyone, that word written three times on my locker burrowed itself into my mind, into the deepest spaces of my spirit, and it hunkered down and metastasized. By which I mean was with me, and every time something else happened, it was a reminder. And I didn't come to terms with that. I didn't tell anybody till I was about 39 or 40 years old that that had ever happened.
Let me read something that you write on page 127. What I know now to have been true of myself in my childhood and young adulthood: 1, I hated being black; 2, I was afraid of black people; 3, I tried to be what white people valued. And again, I mean, this is what makes your life and your book so both interesting and confusing and profound and all of that, is that here you were a black family living in a white neighborhood. Your parents wanted you to be black, and yet you, as you say here, I hated being black.
This is what racism does to us, Marty. You know, I think I'm a mom, right? I've got an 18-year-old and a 16-year-old. My job is to love my kids fiercely, feed them, water them, give them shelter, try to prepare them for what the world will ask and expect and demand. When you are black, when you are of color, when you are of a status that is disregarded by many due to class, perhaps immigrant status, there are all kinds of ways in which people can be made to feel like the other. For me, it was my blackness. What happens is that majority viewpoint, that stereotype, the small cuts, the large cuts, they start to eat away at you. They start to eat away at you and make you feel inadequate. And for many of us, it leads to what people who study this call self-loathing. Yeah. And I'm able to say now, I plunged into that place of self-loathing and spent probably 2 decades there trying not to be who the white folks feared, loathed, hated, disregarded. I was trying to be black, but smart, black, but, you know, law-abiding, right? I'm responding to the negative stereotypes. And of course, in some ways, believing the negative stereotypes, right? So I had to come out from under that BS and learn how to love myself in this skin, be more than that, proud of my ancestry, proud of my ancestors and my heritage, and ultimately really proud of the black community.
Let me just quickly reintroduce you because I know people want to join our conversation. That's Julie Lithcott-Hames. And again, we are talking about her memoir. It's called Real American. And you can join our conversation by calling us at 1-888-477-9499. You can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. And you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. And I know for a lot of people growing up, how they feel inside doesn't connect with how they look on the outside. Student body president, I'm talking about you. You went to Harvard Law School. You got into Stanford. I mean, all these would be all those little check marks of, right. This is what a successful person looks like. Mm-hmm. This is what a successful person does. But deep inside, as you said, this deep insecurity, self-doubt, mm-hmm. maybe even self-hatred, is that true?
Absolutely. Yeah, what's the question?
I guess the question is, how do you did any of those things mean anything to you? All those quote-unquote successes.
And I didn't mean that last, what's the question, to be rude. I was like, I'm not knowing what Marty wants me to answer here. Well, this harkens back to my last book, How to Raise an Adult, and how obsessed we all are with brand name colleges and universities. Mm. I guess what it meant to me was, I have arrived. I have made it to a place the white folks value. They will therefore value me more. I will have greater access to opportunity professionally because I've been at these places, or so I'm told. I felt a bit chosen, a bit special. And I think that was, in the aggregate, positive. I'm proud to have gone to Harvard Law School, but you know, I went to Harvard Law School to try to be a public interest lawyer, and because that's why I wanted to be a lawyer. I had Thurgood Marshall's picture on my wall in college, and I might have been better in a community that was even more devoted to public interest law than the Harvard Law School community is. I had great mentors there, Charles Ogletree, Martha Minow. I found some community there in the Civil Rights, Civil Liberties Law Review. But I might have been better off at a less fancy brand name place that was even more solidly devoted to public interest work. I ended up emerging from there doing corporate law because I felt the drumbeat in my community was everyone gets a corporate law job.
Oh, interesting.
Now, I know my own insecurities were I need, as a black woman, to go get the corporate job so I can impress the people that I have gotten the corporate job. So again, that was my own psyche at work, really not allowing me to make choices aligned with my own values.
This book is, in many ways, there are some love stories in here, I should say, to our listeners, including your dad, who we heard about, and your husband, Dan, who adores you and adored you and saw something in you that you didn't see in yourself, including your hair.
So Dan, the former Dan Hames, now Dan Lithcott-Hames for the last 25 years, we met in college. He's white and Jewish. And we lived in the same dorm the first year we were dating. And I came out of the girls' bathroom with my yellow robe on and my little shower caddy and my little flip-flops. And I had just showered, so my hair was wet, and as any sister knows listening to this show, that meant I had corkscrew hair plastered to my face. And I'd never worn my hair natural. I wear my hair natural now, letting all of the curls just do their thing. But here I was, a 20-year-old, and I was straightening my hair every day. Would never leave my room without straightening my hair. Felt it had to be polished, had to be pressed, had to be straight in order not to raise the concerns of community, white folks, et cetera. Couldn't go to the Stanford Shopping Center without making sure my hair looked, you know, neat for them. So I come out of the shower and I'm just trying to make it back to my room. I have no makeup on in addition to, of course. Dan comes around the corner, my boyfriend, and he goes, "You have curly hair." And all of a sudden, the memory of those high school boys who I had crushes on, who teased me about my strange, in their eyes, hair, just came flooding back. And I clutched my robe close to my chest, and I stepped backward from Dan. And I said, "Yeah."
And he question said, mark, yeah?
Yeah. And he said, "I love it." And I just thought, who are you? I don't love it. I don't love my natural hair. I've been taught that it's a problem. I've been taught that it's not beautiful. And here you are, you know, seeing me in all my unvarnished glory. He was really saying, you know, who you actually are is beautiful. And I like to say, it took my white husband, my then white boyfriend, to help me love my black hair.
I'm tearing up.
I'm tearing up.
You're tearing up as you're talking about this.
Yeah, for sure.
I mean, I guess that.
You know, people, I think people outside the black community don't appreciate what hair is for us. But black women have been told since the beginning that our hair is a problem. We are still told that today in the workplace, in the military, how we choose to do our hair, how we cope with our hair when it can be difficult in the weather or the circumstance. You know, this is, you know, standards of beauty, norms of Western beauty confront us all the time. And so it is an act of personal and political confidence to wear our hair the way it is and to love it the way that it is. There are articles, there are books, there's research written about black hair. One of my former mentors, Connell Jackson, used to teach a class at Stanford on black hair. But the conservative kids at Stanford would just joke about it as if it was an absurd class because they had no interest in trying to even think about why this might be an important cultural issue for us. So yeah, it's an emotional issue for me. I'm thrilled that I wear my hair naturally now and that my children were born to a mother who wears her hair natural.
Did your dad know about Dan?
No.
And,
no, go ahead.
Did my dad know? I asked that only because your dad had said when you were in high school, you know, white boys may be your friends, but they're never going to date you.
Did my dad know? I cut you off. Did he know that I was going to wear my hair natural?
Oh, no.
Mary Dan. Yes. Here's the thing. My dad told jokes about other groups when I was growing up, okay? My dad told jokes about other ethnic groups, including Jews, okay? My dad told jokes. And so I was nervous bringing not this white boy home, but this Jewish boy home. I was nervous. Right. So we drive across country. We're meeting my parents for the first time. They now live in New York, which is where they moved while I was at Stanford. And we're gonna stay the night with them, and they're going to take us to Chinese food. And we are grubby from the road. And so I say, you know what? Let me just take a shower before we go out for Chinese food. And I leave Dan alone with my daddy and mother. Mm. And I'm gone for 25 minutes. I come back. Dan now is taking a shower. My dad goes, baby, it's clear he adores you. And that's all that matters to me.
Wow. Julie Lithcott-Hames, our guest in this hour of Radio Times. Her memoir is titled Real American, and we're talking about her family, her life, race, identity, all those big topics. And again, you can join our conversation, especially if you connect with what we're talking about, 1-888-477-9499. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen talking with Julie Lithcott-Hames. And in case you're joining us, she's got a new book, a memoir called Real American. She also wrote a book a couple of years ago, How to Raise an Adult, which was and probably still is a bestseller. She was dean of freshman students at Stanford University, where she graduated. She's also a graduate of Harvard Law School and currently has an MFA in writing from the California College of the Arts. And again, you can join our conversation. That phone number, 1-888-477-9499. You can also send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and tweet us at WHYY Radio Times to join our conversation. Let me get Tom from, looks like, New Jersey to join us on Radio Times. And Tom, go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi. How you doing?
Good. How are you?
Good. I'll give you a little bit about myself. I'm like 6 years old. I have a biracial 7-year-old granddaughter who I love to the max. How'd your grandparents handle it?
Thanks, Tom.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for calling, and how lucky your biracial granddaughter is that you love her to the max. You know, my father was 50 when I was born, so his parents were gone. They were not a part of my life except in storytelling, which I cherished. Mm. My mother was raised in England, and her parents were there. They both died when I was 8. So while I visited them two or three times before they passed, they weren't really a part of my upbringing. So I didn't have the presence of grandparents. What I'll say to you is your biracial granddaughter is fortunate, and for you to love her fiercely is a precious gift to her. So thanks for calling.
Yeah, Tom, thanks for the call to Radio Times. You have two kids, you and your husband, a boy and a girl.
Yes.
And you talk about with your son having, quote unquote, the talk.
Yeah.
And also about complexion. It sounds as if your daughter is perhaps more light-skinned than your son.
Yeah. So whenever you play the interracial marriage and child birth lots, you don't know who you're going to end up with, right? The variations are infinite. And my son resembles me more, and my daughter resembles my husband more. Yeah.
And the talk with your son is about how to be in the world as a young black man?
It is. Obviously, we're all aware of what has been happening increasingly lately, it seems, or perhaps we're only more aware of it because of video and whatnot. But violence toward black men, brown men and boys and women and girls at the hands of law enforcement. And my job is to raise my kids to be to keep them safe until they can keep themselves safe. And so as he emerges out into the world and starts to drive and starts to hang out with friends in the evenings and go to places where, you know, I'm not there holding his hand. He's 18. He's not eight. My job as a black mom with a black son is to help him be smart and safe out there. And so we black parents give our sons in particular the talk about how to behave if they are pulled over, if there is an altercation of some kind. We know that in the minds of some, there is an implicit bias that brown or black skin equals bad, equals criminal, equals thug. And if you're in a group, as my son might be, a group of Asian kids, Latino kids, white kids, black kids, some of those kids are going to be singled out as the problem, my son included, others not. And so how to behave. And my the part that brings tears to my eyes is my son is one of these kids who's always listening to music. And before you could clip off your earbud, you know, at the little cord that hangs by your cheek, sure, he would reach into his pocket to turn off his phone. And I would say to him, you know, if anything happens, don't reach into your pocket, right? The research shows us if you reach into your pocket, they think, some of them think you're reaching for a gun. You will not have a second chance. You know, do not just hands in the air. Hands in the air. Doesn't matter if you know you're right. You know you didn't do anything wrong, right? Your job is to come home safe. Your job is to come home. We can argue tomorrow about the rightness or wrongness of the fact that somebody pulled you over or somebody questioned you.
What kind of neighborhood are your kids growing up in?
They're growing up in Silicon Valley, Palo Alto, California, a hoity-toity community, you know, of wealth and privilege. And in some ways, that's a protective factor. And in some ways, it leaves them really naked because they don't know what it's like out there in the world.
Right. Including your daughter?
Yeah. My daughter, I think, has a really multiracial identity. She knows mm-hmm. who she's from and who she's descended from. She often gets the question, who's that guy you're hanging out with? Are you dating him?
Meaning her brother.
Her brother. They're right. Very close. They might walk down the hall at school together. They're incredibly close, which just brings me tremendous joy. And so she's gotten the question when I show up to pick her up at dance or I show up to pick her up someone, who's that? My mom. Uh-huh. That's your mom? Right? Because people are saying you don't match your mother. And of course, Marty, that's the feedback I got throughout my childhood. Being at a grocery store, putting the groceries down on the conveyor belt, the clerk is trying to figure out where do these white ladies' groceries end and this black girl's groceries begin. And my mother says, no, it's this for all of us. For both, you know, all of this is ours. And the clerk is looking at me like, you don't belong to this lady.
Wow. Wow. And this is current. I mean, we are a more diverse country, even though I think for a lot of people, they don't necessarily live in diverse worlds.
Yeah. My conveyor belt story is from my own childhood, but these stories of, you know, my kids not, Avery not being told she matches us, that's a very recent story. The Bay Area is quite diverse. We chose to raise our kids there because we didn't want them to feel like the other, the way I felt in the middle of Middleton, Wisconsin. So it does help to be raised in a community where there are a lot of different kinds of folks where you don't make assumptions about who goes with whom and who doesn't.
Yeah. Let me get, looks like Danielle from Doylestown to join our conversation. And Danielle, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
Thank you both, Mario. Love your show.
Thank you.
I am the white Jewish mom of a biracial girl, and she has very curly hair. She's 6 years old, and she wears it natural. And we recently moved from New York City, which is obviously very diverse, to Bucks County, which is not so diverse.
Right.
And people always comment on our hair all day long. Oh, it's so beautiful. It's so amazing. And a lot of people want to touch her hair without asking. And I'm sure you can relate to this.
Yep.
But it's a very delicate thing because you know, they're doing it in an admiring way. Oh, it's beautiful. We love your daughter's hair. It's so beautiful. And they just come in, and it's quite invasive, makes her feel uncomfortable. And do you have any...
Oh, yes, indeed, Danielle.
our
guest is... Sure, our guest is scribbling notes as you talk.
Danielle. I've experienced that in childhood. I've experienced that in the workplace as a grown woman. And here's a message to all white women who want to touch the hair of black or biracial people. Do not do it. We are not zoo animals. We are not exotic. When you touch our hair and fluff it with your hands and say ooh and ah and bounce it like a beach ball, it summons a genetic memory for us, as I write in the book, of being sized up at auction according to the size of our birthing hips and the ripeness of our breasts. Do not touch us. It is inappropriate. Now, as a mom of this lovely little girl, you know, you don't want to get all up in people's faces and get all angry, but you can say, if it's a friend, you can say after the fact, please don't touch her hair. It's a thing. You could just say it's a thing. It's just not cool. And then you let your daughter know, you know what, honey, it's not cool when people touch your hair. They do it because it's different, but you talk with your daughter about it so she knows you're allied with her. You're taking her side in that rather than that you think it's okay.
You call these thanks a lot for calling in, Danielle. You call these microaggressions, which is sort of it's a loaded term.
Yeah, it's sort of loaded and unloaded, right? Micro seems to imply very minor and, you know, microscopic, doesn't matter, hardly seen. And it's not my term, obviously. It's a term in our lexicon, in our dialogue. I think the point of them is they accrue over time and they begin to reshape us. To me, they're like the drip, drip, drip from a poisonous pipe that just lands, you know, that drips on your head and begins to erode and reshape and contort and distort our bodies, our psyche, and it harms us.
You describe, I guess you were at Stanford at the time, and someone assuming you were at Stanford because you had some kind of athletic scholarship, or you were there because you were part of a...
What sport are you on?
A sports...
What team are you on?
What team are you on? Exactly.
Yeah, and any black person who went to, you know, a tier one college is probably nodding their head and saying, yeah, happened to me. That's the presumption. Oh, you go to fill in the blank school? What team are you on? In other words, you didn't get in. I'm sure you didn't get in on the basis of your brain. You must have got in on the basis of your athletic status. And it's one of those presumptions they make. They don't even realize that. But that's, again, that implicit bias.
And Danielle, thanks for calling into Radio Times. And again, you can call 1-888-477-9499. Let me read a comment from Leslie. She says, I'm racial, but I can pass growing up hearing all the racism and hating myself for remaining silent.
Yeah, Leslie, boy, do I feel you. My colleague and friend Allison Hobbs, professor at Stanford of History, wrote a beautiful book, A Chosen Exile, and it's about the history of passing in America. Of course, our folks have passed for centuries as more and more black folks in slave days were raped by plantation owners. Some of us became lighter and lighter and ultimately could pass into the white community. And by passing, we attained privilege, but also experienced this deep wound of loss that we were disassociated from the people who were the only people that ever loved us. And so there is deep pain in passing. And I would invite you, I don't know how old you are, but I would invite you to be interested in what lies ahead for you. Whatever happened in the past is the past, but what and how do you want to be tomorrow? And can you locate a self despite your light skin, despite your ability to pass? Can you connect with communities of color, with issues related to what communities of color face, and be present and allow people to understand what your ancestry and identity is? My guess is that you will find nourishment and a deeper sense of belonging.
An email from Frizzell. He says, as a black man, I feel the guest has had as black a life experience as the rest of us, metaphorically speaking. The isolation that she felt while being surrounded by people and not fully fitting in is reflective of the reality of black Americans.
Yeah, Frizzell, that's beautiful. Thank you for saying that.
In fact, you write, and I'm sort of picking up in the middle of the book here, many years later, I would learn that blackness was less about skin color or hair or language, and more, far more, about a lived, conscious committedness to issues that impact black people. And I would accept my light-colored skin, the sound of my voice, the biracial kink of my hair, and you go on from there.
Yeah. When I was trying to figure out what black was in the early to mid-'80s, late-'80s, I, again, had the stereotype as my guide. And, you know, what I've come to appreciate as I've grown up is... blackness is that you can have incredibly light skin and be deeply involved in caring about and working for the betterment of the Black community. You can have incredibly dark skin and be disinterested in all of that. Your skin color is not your calling card, even though in the Black community, we do a lot of joking and prodding of each other around whether we're too dark or too light. I've learned, and I give a nod to my colleague Jan Barker Alexander at Stanford, an associate dean there. She was somebody who really opened my eyes to the complex diversity within Blackness. And because I admired her and because she was such a leader, I was really able to be more attuned to the ways in which I might actually be Black enough, despite speaking the way I do, having the white mother, and having this hair.
Let me see what Jennifer from Philadelphia has to say. Jennifer, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hi, yes, there. Good morning. Thank you so much. I just wanted to say I am a Black woman. I am of mixed race background. My family is extremely diverse. I had a grandmother who had blonde hair and blue eyes. I do have natural hair that I wear curly in the summer, straight in the winter. And I cannot tell you how many Black and white colleagues have commented on my hair, wanted to touch my hair, asked me what I am, what are you? You're not really Black. What are you? You can't be Black. You look different. And I applaud you for writing this book, for being a voice, for speaking for people like me, because I get the questions and the hair touching from both sides, and at times it's just so tiresome. I just want to be. So I want to thank you so much for being here and being a voice.
Jennifer, thanks.
Thank you, Jennifer. Thanks so much. You know, I'm not getting that from Black folks. I'm sorry that you are. It doesn't feel good, regardless of who's doing it, although... I don't know. Yeah, I'm glad to know that story.
Jennifer, thanks for the call to Radio Times. As I said, there's much in this book about how much your husband loves you and you love your husband. But you also do have a section about if I had married a Black man, what would my life have been?
I say that marrying a white guy was inevitable because I was on this trajectory, white schools, white community, white life, you know, despite how I look, despite my ancestry. And but then I say Dan wasn't inevitable because he was a gift, because he's an amazing human. And then I had two kids with Dan, and I gave my Black son, who to me looks like Trayvon Martin. He doesn't actually look like Trayvon, but I can't look at Trayvon's face still these many years later because I just see my son and I weep. I weep just talking about it. So my sadness is I didn't give my Black son a Black father.
Oh.
I didn't give my son a male mentor in a father who knows what it's like. So my woke white husband does his best to educate himself and be the kind of father our son needs. But sometimes I wouldn't have the son without the white husband, but I gave my son a white father. And so it's not that I am longing. I mean, I love Black men. I'm attracted to all kinds of people. And so I'm not saying I wish I had a Black husband. But I do know that I chose that the whiteness of my spouse was inevitable, given when I married, which was my young 20s. And had I not, you know, found a life partner until now, I would, you know, quite possibly have found a partner of color, if only because my world is so much more diverse now. So much more diverse. So there are just all kinds of people around me.
Well, I hate to end our conversation.
Are we done?
We are done.
What?
I'm sorry to
Marty.
Say that. The clock is telling me.
No way.
Julie Lithcott-Hames, thank you so much for joining us today on Radio Times.
What a thoughtful conversation, Marty. Thank you.
You're very welcome. Thank you. And her memoir is titled Real American. She also wrote a book, a bestseller, in fact, called How to Raise an Adult. And you can go and watch her do a TED Talk about how to raise an adult. Go to WHYY.org/Radio Times. And you can find out much more about the program. You can download a podcast of the show. Find us on Facebook. Follow us on Twitter. And we did take some photos of both of us before the show began, so you can check those out as well. Diana Martinez, the engineer for today's edition of Radio Times. The show is produced by Debbie Builder, John Ahrens, and Trinae Nuri. I'm Marty Moscoane. Thank you for joining us.